Come with me for the last time in this series to page 587, to this extraordinary book of Ecclesiastes. By the way, if you've been fascinated by this book and you want to take it any further, can I recommend to you this little commentary, the Bible Speaks Today series, The Message of Ecclesiastes by Derek Kidner. It's the one that first intrigued me in this book, and we've got a number of copies on the bookstall at the back. Do go and grab one afterwards. There's also one copy of another one by a man called Walter Kaiser, entitled Total Life, which is also very well worth getting. But you've got to be quick. Well, now, Ecclesiastes 2. We're going to move out of the world of the academic and the mastermind that we were in last week. We're into a world that we all know something about, the world of pleasure and entertainment. I said to myself, come now, I'll make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself. The exam we all want to take. Here's this man of wealth and power, able to indulge himself as he pleases, as we'll discover, and he's going to put pleasure and himself to the test. We've been studying in recent weeks, haven't we, that this is a man who's wanting to make us explore the avenues and see if this is where life lies. And this is the road we're going down today, the road of pleasure. Let me say, by way of introduction, I do hope that you're not switched off him as we heard what he had to say. I do hope you've come to realize that he's not out of date, because our pleasures may seem so much more sophisticated that this man doesn't have anything to say to us. But those of you starting hospital life with all the facilities and the opportunities that that provides, you'll find many of them mirrored, the good ones and the ugly ones, in what he has to say. For yuppies amongst us, you'll discover that this man has his Filofax as full as yours. Now, I'm told that yuppies don't have Filofaxes now. They have desk organizers called Psion or something or other. Anyway, this man has his own social whirl, and he's got his lists of telephone numbers and contacts and so on. I was shown someone's official Sloan Ranger handbook again the other day. The first guide to what really matters in life. Kill salmon, drink seriously. Put the great into Britain and the hooray into Henry. Well, Mr. Preacher could have been writing not the official Sloan Ranger handbook. You'll find most of what's there debunked in here. No, he's not out of date. And he's not irrelevant to us at St. Helens. I hope we're not also falling into the trap of thinking, well, yes, this is going to be the obvious night, isn't it? We all know that in the end preachers are against pleasure and anything exciting. And the more lurid it is, the more obviously they're against it. And it's not really relevant to us. I'm just a good Christian boy or girl at St. Helens. I hope we're wiser than that. I hope we know that large numbers on a Sunday night, and the ability which most of us have to at least look Christian for an hour and a half, can be deceptive. That immorality and materialism are not that far absent from many of us. We might be sad about that. We shouldn't be too surprised, should we? We're living in a world where they're not only accepted, but they're boasted about, and many of us have the opportunity to enjoy them and indulge ourselves in them. Well, Mr. Preacher is writing as he writes. He's writing from his perspective under the sun, standing where anyone might stand, not bringing God into things, just looking at the world as it looks, and he's writing to the person who's also going to look like that and say, listen, you can go down the road to pleasure, and you still haven't got it. But he's writing to those of us who are Christians. Those of us who might be tempted down this cul-de-sac, and he's warning us, the grass is not greener. It's the reason we go down, isn't it? We're not fools either. We wouldn't if it didn't look like that. Well, he's saying, I've explored it. I just pray that he guards some of us tonight. And look at the range in which he's going to look at as we finish his introductory verses. Verse 2, I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? There's a subtle little distinction between these two things, laughter and pleasure. Laughter is something that's more lightweight, more just sort of off the cuff, more basic, more frivolous. It's the kind of fun you have at a game or a party. It's the sort of court jester character. Always good for a laugh, a quick line, a funny quip, the life and soul of any party, and then you discover there's nothing more to him. He says it's mad. No, not medically mad, but he's lost his judgment. He's lost his perspectives. He won't face the facts. He'll just drown them in a sea of frivolity, another joke. It's easy to head down the road to becoming that character, isn't it, if you're good at them? Pleasure is more heavyweight, more highbrow, more respectable. Oh yes, here is the music lover, the drama fanatic, the opera goer. And he says of pleasure, what use is it? He's not saying we're not to have fun and we can't enjoy life or anything like that. He's just going back to our question we've always got nagging at us all the time through this. He says, what do you gain at the end of it? You've gone on that tremendous world, it's become all your life. What use is it? What's it changed? Well, come and join him on the spree and see if you can recognize all sorts of pleasures in it. The spree, this is what the heart of this passage we had read to us is about, verses 3 to 10. And you will see exactly the range of things he tries out. We notice when it came to wisdom and knowledge that he was thorough in his experiments. He is with pleasure. Verse 3, he tries wine. I search with my mind how to cheer my body with wine. And so they are today. Henry's day in the Sloan Ranger handbook. Henry comes into work and we have now for the unfun bit, and they skip all the morning until the lunch hour, and the unfun bit begins again. And at last it's time for the really fun bit to start. This is going home. Henry may stop off at a stand-up-and-shout cocktail party, or be going out to dins. Otherwise, he will head straight for the Young Sloan's HQ. Various bars are mentioned, no advertising here. There the barman builds him several drinks. Snorts and wets are what rangers call them. The Noizak is turned up full blast at them all. Eventually, Henry has enough alcohol, joke and gossip in his bloodstream for one day, and the bachelor Sloanes head home, stoned out of their mind, to cod in a bag, ambrosia, creamed rice, toast and the telly. After telly shuts down, he builds himself a chutney sandwich, and the married squadron go back to their Carolines and cutlets and candlelight if it's still the early days. That's roughly what he's saying in verse 3. But of course, Sloanes are an easy target, because when you're poking fun at them, well, everyone wants to pretend it's someone else. I was rather shocked to go home one evening this week and just turn on the television for the local London news, and amidst all sorts of exciting things that are happening in the southeast, I came across this fact: 20% of hospital beds in London are taken up with alcohol-related diseases. That is, and no pun intended, a sobering thought, isn't it? Now, these pleasures aren't out of date. Just check in the wine bars at lunchtime. Just look around them weekdays in the evenings. They're crowded. There's many a person who's searching with their minds how to cheer their body with wine or beer or whatever it is they're drinking. And then he moves on. He tries something else, something totally different. This is the genius of this man. You'll see it. He goes from something as basic as drink in verse 3 to now a completely different sort of sphere. Verses 4 to 6, his creativity comes out. I made great works. I built houses. He's something of an architect. I planted vineyards for myself, gardens, parks, all kinds of fruit trees, pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. He's into landscape gardening. Yes, he's got these talents. Don't write him off as just one of the boozy crowd. Like a number of them, there's a hidden genius behind it all. Why, he's got possessions. Oh, he's got them all right. Look at verse 7. I bought male and female slaves, had slaves born in my house. I had great possession of herds and flocks, more than anyone who'd been before me in Jerusalem. It's a lot easier with Barclaycard, isn't it? Don't have to pay with a sheep or a cow or two. But it's the same thing. He's got silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. He's got far more than any student grant will give you. So we're not going to outplay him at this game, are we? There's no pleasure he won't be able to afford. Now, he's got something to teach us, all right. Look down at verse 8 again. I got singers. He's into music. Both men and women. He's like Nigel, you know, he's got his choirs. He's organizing them all left, right, and center. Yes, he knew the attraction and the magnetism of this kind of pleasure. It doesn't have to be music, does it? I mean, we've seen people who've been sucked into a world and made a world of something like this, haven't you? And as I say, it didn't be music, it can be drama, it can be chess, it can be sport, it can be almost anything, butterfly collections, any hobby becomes absorbing. Now, there are some of the sort of things even in this list that we'd never boast about. Our world is this, things like drink. I live for booze. No, well, people might boast about it, but they wouldn't seriously claim it. There are others, aren't there, that are far, far more respectable. So respectable, we don't see any danger there. We don't think we could possibly be barking up a blind alley. I live for my art, my writing, my great works and my music. Do you see, Mr. Preacher has tried both ends of the spectrum. Yes, and also many concubines, man's delight. We've had the wine, we've had the song, he doesn't leave out the women. All the women a man could want, one version translates it. And that's it. He's not only boasting about it, he's done it. So I became great, surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. You name it, he did it. This is quite a spree, isn't it? I do hope we see this. Mr. Preacher knew how to enjoy himself. He loved this test. He was thrilled by all the conquests he was making. So do listen carefully to him when he passes his verdict. Not boring old stuffy old Hugh Palmer telling you don't. It's this man who's been through it all. The spree. We've got to listen to his verdict, and he brings it. Verse 11. Actually, verse 11, right through to verse 23. We might call this the morning after the night before. Look. That little word at the beginning of verse 11, that's the moment he wakes up. Then. You know, that horrible feeling the morning after the night before, when finally consciousness actually penetrates. That wretched alarm clock, you know, that keeps going every 20 minutes if you don't stop it. And it's doing it for about the 10th time. And you get up and you look in the mirror, and in the cold light of day, remember. Those are the thoughts he's capturing in verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I'd spent in doing it. Then I considered, then he had the guts, then he faced the facts, then he wasn't content just to sort of put a brave face on it and pretend, well, it must have been great, we did it and we'll go on doing it. That's why this man is wise, by the way. That's why he can say that his wisdom remained with me. He's one of the few people who could be so ensconced in the world and then be wise enough to step back and check. People who get trapped in worlds so rarely do it, don't they? We hate to step outside and look. David Stanley, you probably haven't heard of, is actually Elvis Presley's stepbrother. It was the 10th anniversary of Elvis's death a few weeks ago. And David Stanley was caught up in Elvis's world, and he went all the way down, and he was only jolted into thinking and considering by another brother of his. He'd gone through the lot. The drink, the girls, the success, the speed, the drugs. And it made him consider Elvis too. I was reading a very compassionate article, and he said this: Elvis had the wealth, the fame, the possessions, everything you could ask for, but he was a victim. Just like so many others have been victims. Now, this man has got the ability to step outside and look at it and ask himself, what's the profit? Now I've been through all of this, what's the gain? You see, it seems the obvious question, doesn't it? What's the point of it all? It is just that we are very reluctant to ask it. I was at a course earlier this week, and one of the things they were encouraging us to do was to evaluate every project we undertook. They got a group of church workers there. And we were all convinced of the value of evaluation and review. In theory, we realized it made sense. You spotted faults, you did it better the next time, and everything else. In practice, we were clergy. And we were brilliant at arguing our way out of it. Instantly the objections came. Listen, that's all very well when you're in an office situation. We work with volunteers. They'd hate to be evaluated. Why? Why should a volunteer not want to do something worthwhile? I don't know whether the volunteers would hate to be evaluated or the clergy would hate to do the evaluating. But it became clear that in a number of cases, no evaluation was going to go on. No one was going to actually bring themselves to the point when they considered. When they asked, what is the gain? When they stepped back from their world and said, where's it leading to? Mr. Preacher does. And he's got the guts to go on looking, even when his verdict is as it is in verse 11. Behold, all was vanity. It was fleeting. It's the trouble. The years go by too quickly. Your creativity dries up, doesn't it? How long do we have at the top? Or whatever level is our top. Having lunch with Gareth Lewis today. He had a birthday recently. He was 33. He thought that was old. I didn't like to disillusion him. But we were just commenting, you see, on if you want to be horrified, you've only got to read the sports pages, haven't you? And you discover that the people of 33 turn back the clock to bring out another fine performance in a career that was at its peak 10 years ago. That is worrying if you're 33. Even more worrying if you're older. A striving after wind. What he was chasing was so elusive. His joy, you see, was in his toil, in verse 10. My heart found pleasure in all my toil. It wasn't that he didn't like what he was doing, he loved it. But the fun was in the chase. Whether what gives you the excitement is making the million, playing the money market, chasing the boys and the girls. He loved the conquest, but when the conquest is made, when you pulled off the deal, there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Well, when he got to retirement and looked back, what an ugly question it is. What was the point of it? See, he's a sad man, isn't he, as you turn over the page? It's very interesting, the lessons he's learning, you see, they keep on and on being repeated in the Times on Saturday. there was an extraordinary article on the middle pages featuring Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley and Maria Callas, the opera singer. Very different people, and yet actually saying the same, coming to the same verdict on them as Mr. Preacher does on life. They were images of us, the public, the article went on. But actually by the end, they were all limp, tired, dispirited, failed, depressed characters. They got everything the world had to offer. They were the top of their respective professions, and they had nothing. Reduced to dredging up tired performances. Now, we probably don't live in that world and at that elite, but for us as well, so often it's going to be chasing the wind. Someone spoke to me recently of his lost years, chasing power and prestige and knowledge and privilege. Well, Mr. Preacher is writing to stop us having to talk like that. He dreads that there'll come that point where we'll have to look back in sorrow and say, yes, I realize I wasted that. So if I'm looking lustfully or longingly or greedily at something or someone, he's trying to say as plainly as he can, look, it's not what it's cracked up to be. Don't give up Christ for that if you're a Christian. Don't go down that track if you're wondering what to do with your life. No, he's not pouring scorn and guilt on us for chasing things. It's just that we've got to face up to the morning after the night before. If you're a medic, we've got to have a post-mortem sooner or later. And we must be honest with it. You notice, I hope, in his appraisal, he doesn't bring guilt into it. He's not saying, you'll feel terribly guilty the next day. Guilt and judgment come in later on. He's just saying at this moment, don't do it, it doesn't work. That's not a bad reason for not doing it. And you see, you wonder where next. Last week we saw that wisdom got us nowhere. This week we see that pleasure gets us nowhere. What's going to happen next? And that's where verse 12 comes in. I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what he's already done. What's the next guy going to do? He can only do what I did, only probably slightly worse. Not as wise as me. Can't have much more fun than I had. Now, this man is not an anarchist. We saw that last week. He knows that wisdom's better than folly. That's just his point. He's getting himself down to the position in verses 17 and 18 where he talks about hating life. See, what makes him bitter is that he knows there are values somewhere around. Wisdom is better than folly. To have achieved something and done great works is better than not to have done it. The thing that maddens him and gets him so angry is, whichever you are, you land up the same. Dead. What's the point? That's why he's bitter. That's why he's hating life. That's why he's hating all his toil, which he toiled under the sun. Who was going to get it once he'd made it? He'd pass it on to the next generation, but they could be wise or stupid. No telling, is there? Our parents once hoped we were wise. Well, it's to this bitter man that Mr. Preacher just wonders if there's someone now ready for a solution. To the man who's followed him this far, and to the person who's seen the kind of point he's getting to, he's wondering, I wonder if it's time to ask them this. And right at the end of chapter 2, in those last three verses, that last paragraph there, he speaks something in this tone. He says, have you ever thought of this? See, he's taken us on the spree, hasn't he? He's made us face up to the morning after the night before, and he's got us to the point where we're saying, well, what is the point? Where on earth do we go now? And it's then as if he just leans across to us and says, well, have you ever considered this? That's what these last three verses are saying. There's nothing smug and condescending about them. He knows he's dealing with a bitter person. with someone who's followed the path of reality to a crushing point. Someone whom he has actually led down this road until they've seen it's a dead end. Now, there isn't a trace of arrogance about it. But he does change hats, so to speak. In these last three verses, he's stopping just looking under the sun. He'll bring God and his faith into the picture. He tentatively pushes it forward. Here's a way of hope. Here's some light at the end of the tunnel. Have you ever tried thinking of life this way, he says? And you're not ready, you don't want to listen. Okay, he'll go straight back, we can explore some more. There's plenty more chapters to come. No, this is just a sample. Actually, these first two chapters are a sample of his book. That's why we've taken this chunk. You've sampled his argument. You've seen some of his little pointers as to why he can say, under the sun, vanity. And here's just a little sample of his answer. Oh, he'll go on to develop both. But look at what he's got to say for the moment. Verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. What can be better than that? He said, doesn't that just contradict all we've been looking at? No. No. He knows that we can't ever get to that position. He's just starting here because what he's wanting to say to me is, look, it's possible, you know, to eat and drink and enjoy your toil, but not your way, not the under the sun way. Now, he's not saying here the sort of, do all of this, tomorrow I die, or as some person put it, have a blast while you last. That's not his theme. No, it's actually a picture of contentment. The striving's gone in these verses. He's not a person who says, run to a monastery and be a Christian there. No, that's not his point. The earth is God's. The earth is good. It's here to be enjoyed. It's possible to do it. No, not by greed, not by going for things. It's quite the reverse. Here is the picture of contentment. Keep a finger in Ecclesiastes. Turn right through with me, will you, to the New Testament, page 197. And I'll show you the same thought. One Timothy chapter 6, verse 6, page 197 of the New Testament. Here's the Apostle Paul, and he could really be commenting on what Mr. Preacher has to say. Look at him. 1 Timothy 6, 6. There is great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. That's Mr. Preacher, isn't it? But if we've food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Well, those who desire to be rich, they fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and hurtful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. Now, it's no good going on the pleasure spree. Through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced their heart with many pangs, but godliness with contentment. Now come back and look at what this man's saying. It's just that. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. That's a great way to live if I could only be contented. This also, verse 24 of chapter 2, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, apart from God, who can eat? Who can have enjoyment? You see, the great contrast here from earlier in the chapter is that now Mr. Preacher suddenly says to us, look, it's possible to have these things and be content if we'll only see them as God's gift and accept them like that. Look at the contrast between these verses. Do you see? Apart from God, who can do it? Look at verse 26. For to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. And now turn back to what we've just been seeing and see there's not a hint of God giving. It's all me getting. Back to verse 4. Let me just read to you these three or four verses. Listen for the I's and me's and my's and myself's. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possession of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, men and women, and many concubines. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. But apart from God, who can do it? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. And if God's given it, death won't end it. It's not chance either, is it? It's not a whimsical God who's just deciding who he'll give it to and who he won't. No, the man who pleases him, God gives. You see, for all the difficulties that Mr. Preacher has, he's got a view of the sovereignty of God that quite triumphs over most of ours, in fact all of ours, I suspect. He's trusting in a God who is in control, even though he can't work it out. He's telling us it's the only way we'll be content and live. And the way God gives is this: to those who please him, who acknowledge him, who trust him, who rely on him, who live in his framework, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and heaping only to give to one who pleases God. Now, those who are Bible boffins will think that he's quite gone against the Bible doctrine of the sinner, because we're all meant to be sinners, and so we are in the Bible. But he's using it in a special way here, isn't he? He's speaking about sinners on the one hand and those who please God on the other. He's speaking about those who will allow life as a gift from God on the one hand. They're the ones who please him. And he's speaking of those as sinners now, just as those who never take life from God's hand. They'll always want to live under the sun. They'll always refuse God's framework. If that's what you're like, then you're the sinner of this verse. And he says, I can never be realistic about life and content living under the sun. I can never be both of those. Actually, I'm not meant to be. You see, I'm not frustrated and feeling it's vanity and a striving after wind by chance. It's because God gives to the sinner too. Did you notice it? The sinner, the one who refuses anything to do with God, well, to him, God gives this frustrating, vain, striving after a wind work. It's not a strange doctrine of God's judgment. Our last excursion today. Romans chapter 1, page 143 of the New Testament. See, we just heard about the frustration that God gives to the sinner. Well, see it here in this great chapter 1. It's a picture of people who refuse to face the truth about God and turn their backs on God. And what's God's verdict? Well, verse 24. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their heart to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies amongst themselves. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to dishonourable passions. No wonder those pleasures don't work. Verse 28, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and to improper conduct. gave them up to a base mind, no wonder wisdom didn't crack it. To improper conduct, no wonder pleasure didn't crack it. Life's meaningless? Yes. That is life. That is actually how God planned it. If you won't acknowledge Him, you'll never find the answer outside of Him. Well, says someone, that is actually too much for me. I've got far too many objections left that this man hasn't even touched on. No good him saying, do you want to think of it this way? I'm not ready to do that. Fine. Actually, he's hardly started producing half of his objections yet, let alone his answers to them. You better sign up for Discovering Christianity and read the rest of the book. But we've finished our time with Mr. Preacher now. Let's pray. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I'd spent in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Sovereign Lord, may Mr. Preacher's words speak truth to us. Spare us from that verdict on our lives. Give us grace, and in your mercy, turn us into those who please you, to whom you might graciously give knowledge and wisdom and joy. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.